Okay, I call to order the House Interim Committee on Education for Wednesday, January 10th. Welcome, everybody, so early in the morning. Okay, we've got an order of agenda. We're going to go through and try to get through this as expeditiously as possible. But before we get going, I would like to have our guest here today, our new rep from the Dalles and Wasco County area, if you could introduce yourself.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me this morning. I'm Daniel Bonham, John Huffman's replacement for District 59. Grew up in Tigard, graduate of Tigard High School, class of 95. Went to Linfield College, worked at Evergreen Airlines for a while before we bought a small business out in the Dalles, and saw that John was moving on and threw my hat in the ring, and here we are today. And thought I would try and engage in the process as much as possible, and I appreciate you having us.
Great.
And including me this morning, so thank
you.
Very
good. Well, we welcome you very much. Glad you're here. Okay, with that, we were going to open up for Representative Helfrich.
Yeah, so information.
Okay, so I would like to open up a informational meeting and bring up Representative Helfrich, who is the new representative from the Hood River area.
Madam Chair, thank you.
To introduce a concept of a bill. We're going to go a little bit of out of order, but he has a meeting that he needs to go to. So, Representative Helfrich.
Sorry about that. Madam Chair, thank you. And Vice Chairs and committee members. My name is Jeff Helfrich. I'm the representative for Hood River District 52, or HD 52. And I take this opportunity to want to be a part of building or going problem solving and moving forward. One of the things for me is I have small children. I have a 3- and 5-year-old at home, and so education is a big factor for me when I look at opportunities. And I think we can talk about all our natural resources that we have in the state of Oregon. I think one of our most important natural resources we have is our children. We need to wrap our arms around those children and come away and educate them as best we can, because our children are our future. And so my vested interest is my children and part of that. And so part of this bill that I have, Legislative Council 262, the draft, is directs the Chief of Education Office to conduct a study on recruitment, retention, mentoring, and professional development of educators who serve students from student groups that may be at risk for experience achievement gaps. Achievement gaps are through different opportunities that may or may not be presented themselves. But with Representative Hernandez, when we were at the Education Summit for Multnomah County, one of the things that they talked about was recruiting and retention. And this bill would mandate that office start the study following 91st day of adjournment of our session, and then sunset on June 30th, 2019, and come back with the reasons why our educators are leaving us or why they're staying, and looking at programs that allow our children to be successful, not just for certain subject matters, but for the program for the whole education system. So with that, any questions?
No, I think what it is an introduction, and when we hear the bill, I assume it's going to be, because what the process is for the folks that are new is that we introduce bills, they're going to the speaker's office, the speaker assigns bills to committees, and then we have hearings on them when we start in February. Yep. But we do want to give an opportunity for our members to introduce their bills before we get to that point.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you so very much, and welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Does anybody else want to discuss any bills on this that they have concepts? Because I have one. And what I have is, I don't think it's been given an LC number yet, but one of the bills that I'm going to personally introduce is to have a task force on rural education, which somewhat fits into this. When I worked for the Oregon Education Association, I had a lot of the rural areas. In fact, I had Hood River, the Dalles, Maupin, all the way down to the Deschutes River, and some other rural areas. And some of the challenges facing rural districts are much different than the urban districts. And part of it deals with, because there's quite a high absentee rate and so on and so forth, but you know, when you have a doctor's appointment and you live in Union and you have to go to Walla Walla for your orthodontist appointment, or if you live 35 or 40 miles away from the school and you miss the bus, then you miss the day of school. And so that's the concept that we're going to have as a task force on rural education, which is about 25% of the students that we have in Oregon. So that's what I'll be doing. Okay, and we had no other concepts that I knew of. Representative Solman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am bringing forward a concept that was just in regards to last session. I brought something forward for unclaimed property. So this one is currently, if there are stocks and bonds within unclaimed property, the account, then they sit in a drawer, and they may be mature. They may have already received their maximum amount, but they just sit in a drawer and collect dust. So my bill will actually say that once they mature, that they would then be cashed out and put into the K-12, put into the common school fund to generate interest to pay towards to our 197 school districts. If somebody still needs to come and claim that bond or whatnot, they still can do that. They would just receive the cashed out amount.
Okay.
Put it
initially there.
So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So. Anybody else have any education concepts? Representative Bonham.
Chair Doherty, I actually do have one. And I'm sorry, I'm so new to this process. I got my bill back. I was so excited. It's sitting up on my desk. I don't know the number. I would guess it was
okay.
261. But I will knock on all your doors later and bug you about it. But
it will get a different number anyway. Yeah. So
okay.
Don't worry.
Don't memorize it.
So the concept is one of the problems I see in the education system today. Is when a teacher or an administrator has a misstep, so to speak, and they then are placed on paid administrative leave. There's an investigation, ultimately ending in a separation agreement, and that separation agreement is bound by a gag order, and that district is happy to be rid of that person, yet they move down the street to another district, and they're rehired, and the problem 3 or 4 years later resurfaces. And so what I'd like to see happen is a file sharing across school districts of employment files to have more transparency when the teachers or administrators move from district to district, or even in some cases in this state within the district, we have that problem that they don't share from school to school.
Okay. Okay, thank you. As I say, bill numbers get assigned once they've been filed with the clerk's office. So that's the process that we use. Okay, any others? Okay, good enough. I'm sure we'll have some more once all of the bills have been introduced and given to the speaker's office. Okay, with that, we're going to close the informational hearing on the discussion of 2018 legislative concepts and open up a informational meeting on the introduction of the new TSPC executive director. And so this is an opportunity to address yourself and so address the committee. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Anthony Rosales, who is the new director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Welcome, especially for the short notice. I saw him 3 days ago or whatever and said, would you like to come? He said, certainly.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Anthony Rosales. I am the executive director with the Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and this is, I think, my sixth or seventh day now on the job, so I'm fairly new, but we're getting right at it. So thank you, Chair Doherty, Vice Chairs Wilson and Hernandez, for allowing me this opportunity to speak to the committee. Thank you, committee members, for allowing me in your presence today. What I wanted to talk about a little bit is about myself, but not in the sense of trying to talk about who I am, because I could do that by giving you a resume. But I, when I was thinking about what to share with you, I was thinking that talking a little bit about my experiences may be able to help elucidate the things we're doing at TSPC and why they're so important given today's ever-changing educational environment. So when I started, I came out of law school and back at UCLA back in 94, and I was thinking I was going to be a tree hugger lawyer. I was going to be a natural resource lawyer here in Oregon, so I took the Oregon bar. But at the same time, I had gotten married, and I had one child on the way, and I was doing a lot of work with students when I was in my undergraduate and law school years, so I picked up substitute teaching. And lo and behold, pretty quickly I realized that I could make as much money teaching as being a public sector interest, public interest lawyer, especially for natural resources, because I didn't want to get into the defense side of it. But that began my journey into education, and it was a journey that I've had the blessings to be able to be in many different parts of the educational field. I started in California as a middle school teacher on an emergency credential, where you just have, I had my law degree, but I didn't have any education prep. So here I go, day one into a classroom in middle school, spent 2 years doing that while I was earning my credential, got out of that work, but right away I was put into some leadership responsibilities, I think maybe because of the legal background. So those of you who may remember the days of coordinated compliance reviews and program quality reviews, I got to do that work, and that was wonderful work. And I then moved into elementary level administration, and then my first opportunity to serve in Oregon was when Beaverton School District hired me in 2001 as their administrator for classified personnel. Did that work for a few years, and then wanted to get more experience in teacher preparation. So I moved back to California, worked at UCLA for a few years in their teacher ed program. The unique experience there was that was the time when UCLA, Stanford, several of the UC schools were developing what I think they believed was a pushback to the current educational trend towards just multiple choice assessments for teachers. So they were developing something called the Performance Assessment for California Teachers. And I was on a team that got to do some pilots with that. We did some review of the standards and research. We spent a whole week up in Stanford, Palo Alto, doing that work. And the that work ultimately evolved to what we know today as EdTPA, which is, of course, our assessment system for completion and demonstration of competencies in practice. I had the blessing to do work as an assistant superintendent for instruction and then for human resources in an Illinois district. Made my way back to California as an elementary school district superintendent and taught administrative preparation at Cal State San Marcos. And most recently on this long journey was the last few years I was at Klamath Community College and down in the, mentioned about rural parts of the state. Rural South Central Oregon, serving Klamath and Lake Counties. Wonderful opportunity there to work with the team there, and I served as the Vice President for Student and Personnel Services as well as the legal counsel for the college. So again, I don't share that because it's a resume list, but because those experiences are what interested me in the position of TSPC. We're at the point now in education where we know we still need to consider equity within our education workforce. We have about 37% of our students are of color in Oregon. We're still hovering around 10 to 11% of our educators are of color. We also know that the curriculum and the interests of the various groups in the curriculum is also continuing to evolve. If we just look at it in the last year or two, the heightened interest in the discussions of what is history and whose history is reflected in our work. These are very important issues for the legislature and for TSPC to consider as we engage in our important work. And that, if I may, I will segue quickly to what we do at TSPC then. At TSPC, we have three primary responsibilities. One is to assure quality licensure of quality educators within the state of Oregon. We also communicate and assure the quality of the educators who are currently within our system through our professional practices division. So most commonly, Representative Bonham, when you mentioned about teachers getting in trouble, so to speak, that they may well end up in front of TSPC on a disciplinary investigation, and that is an important piece of the work we do. The legislature has found this to be very important work because of the four key performance measures that we have. They are primarily directed at our customer service in licensure and in professional practices, so the discipline area. However, with me coming on board TSPC, one of the things I made clear in the selection process and one of the things that I believe that the commissioners are interested in is that third prong of it, which is assuring quality education preparation programs. our needs are changing. Our students continue to change. We need to assure that those education preparation programs are providing the most robust, rigorous, relevant curriculum that addresses the needs of our students. And with the experiences I've had since I've worked with everywhere from Head Start students up to doctoral students, I'm hoping I can contribute to that discussion. And how we will do this is by collaboration. One of the things I also noticed in my years in education is that we still have a lot of silos. And silos are things that in the education world will not breed success for students. It breeds redundancy. It breeds operational and fiscal inefficiencies. And it also leaves our community and our stakeholders often wondering what we're doing with all the resources that you know, we're advocating for. Why aren't our numbers, you know, our student success indicators going up and whatnot? So it is a very, education is a very complicated place, and more so now than ever. And I look forward to this opportunity to work in supporting the educators, because we have a lot of good educators in Oregon, and we need to support them, but we need to do it strategically, collaboratively, comprehensively, working with all the five agencies that touch education in the state to have a common message about how we support our students all the way from pre-K all the way through, yes, through the doctoral level and then beyond. So thank you for allowing me this opportunity to spend time with you.
Thank you. Do you have any questions or for the good doctor? Yes, Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here today. I was curious about, as we're hearing in our school districts across Oregon are developing and stepping up on their career technical education, you know, programs within their school districts. Can you tell me a little bit how, because I know there was a concern about certification and is that the correct term for the, licensure for CTE teachers. So I was wondering if you've had some thoughts or some, you know.
Thank you, Representative Solman, for asking that question. Career technical education is an heightened awareness, and especially from my work that I saw at Klamath Community College recently and developing the partnerships between the colleges and the K-12 districts and providing more of that robust CTE, what we call CTE education. The licensure area is still based on a more traditional model of content preparation, content assessment, so teachers have demonstrated competencies in their content area, and then moving on to pedagogical skills, which allow them the skills of teaching, and then we assess those. So the CTE area is an area where I can't say much about where we're at today. It's something I have to definitely dig more into, mm-hmm. but I do know it's an area where we need to continue to be creative in how we look at supporting the licensure of those areas, because they don't necessarily lend themselves to a very traditional model of coming and take a test on, you know, multiple choice test that demonstrates that you can do welding or, you know, that you can do agriculture work. So it's a very good question that we need to dig into.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here and welcome. So Dr. Monica Beam, your predecessor, had done a phenomenal job of turning around the delays in licensure, returning phone calls, returning emails to people that contacted the office after a whole lot of work for a lot of years to get there. And so that was phenomenal work. Certainly, I just want to tune you into that and the importance of that. Sitting on Ways and Means Education Subcommittee for years, we wrestled with that, saw a turnaround. I'm quite excited about that turnaround because it serves those good teachers that we talk about in a better, more efficient way. So I just want to put that on your radar, that's pretty important to this body. We watch that a lot because if we do want those good educators to continue being good educators, we've got to at least return phone calls and emails in a timely fashion, not a week. So in light of that, can you share with us a little bit on your sixth day, you said? There's a lot of grace here. On your sixth day, as you have looked at the agency and where it's at, what are some of your thoughts for continuing the good work and moving forward to streamline things to bring us into the 21st century in that agency?
Thank you, Representative Spranger, for this very important question. And it's a reminder that I believe it was back in 2015 when the legislature actually requested an audit of TSPC, primarily regarding its timeliness and practices, whether it was responding to phone calls, responding to emails, the length of time to licensure. There's a KPM that talks about what's the percentage of our licensing applications that we're processing within 30 days. There's also in the disciplinary investigations, how many of those are being resolved within 180 days. So they are very important items to consider, because we need to remember, as an agency, as any agency needs to remember, which recently serving in the field, I can tell you the impression sometimes is we do forget that we as agencies exist to serve the public. The public doesn't exist to serve the agencies, and that we need to continue to remember that. So when I came on board, one of the things I did is I talked with the two directors. We have wonderful staff at TSPC, and they were very interested in developing these improvement efforts to in responsiveness. And we have two great directors, Trent Donowski and Elizabeth Keller, who are working respectively on the professional practices in the licensure area. And those are key measures that they're always aware of. We know that we're continuing to look at technology. We recently hired, he just started about the same time I did, a new technology person within TSPC to kind of support Matt, who we already have working on that. Because we know some of the things, the next step for us in the evolution of that is moving a very public, what we would call technologically friendly interface, and making that happen also at the level of the TSPC staff. Our first efforts, and with Dr. Bean and kind of leading that effort, was to try to make that interface for the public as seamless as possible. We need to continue to look at ways within TSPC staff processing of licensing to make that more technologically rich, because as I've come to learn is that we're doing good to try to support the public side, but on the staff side, we still then take that nice data, and it still becomes more of a paper-driven process. So those are one of the next steps we need to do. So I think the challenge for me is to continue those efforts in doing that, while I also know, and I believe that the commission hired me knowing my interest in working on program development. So we definitely have our work cut out for us. But it's a challenge that I know the staff's up to speed in. I think it's fair for the legislature also to know that, to be remember that we are what I used to call in the college world an enterprise fund, meaning that we basically spend what we earn, and we therefore are very lean. And changes in the climate of education licensure can affect those revenues and therefore what we do. So we do have to be very, very astute in our work in monitoring our budgets, monitoring our results, because we are a public service agency.
Thank you.
And please know that, please let us know if the legislature can best serve you in your new role. We would appreciate that.
Thank you. I look forward to working with the legislature.
Thank you very much, and welcome to your new job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I'm closing the informational meeting on the introduction of the new TSPC director, and open an informational meeting on the state longitudinal data system. And so, John Starr and Lauren Lane. And please, this is all such new stuff. I heard this last week, and it's very good, so. Welcome.
Cheers. Good morning, everyone.
Do you want to put the microphone a little closer to you?
Is that better? A little bit?
Is that better?
A little more.
Yeah, that's
better. Excellent. Perfect. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Hernandez, Vice Chair Wilson, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to present to you today. For the record, my name is John Starr. I am with the Chief Education Office. I function in the role of Project Director for the Statewide Longitudinal Data System. I'd also like to introduce Dr. Laura Lean. She's a qualitative researcher for the Chief Education Office, and will share with you a researcher's perspective of the data system. I want to be respectful of your time today. I did get some excellent feedback last Friday, and I want to allow time for a question and answer after the presentation. And with that, no questions, we'll proceed.
And with your presentation.
So today, the agenda will talk about an overview of the purpose of the system, current status. I'll show you a timeline. This is a six-month timeline, so it's near future and current. We can have some conversation about future. Some quick data examples, visualizations, and reports that the system will provide. Again, touch base on the research perspective, and then enter into question and answer. So, purpose. We want to improve student learning, and this is achieved via the automated access to current student data over multiple years within multiple learning settings across the P1T education continuum. P being preschool through workforce. So that will provide a specific perspective over that continuum from beginning of preschool all the way into workforce. We want to be able to quickly view unique student cohorts across multiple years. The research community, administrators, policymakers will have the ability to set specific cohorts that they so choose within the system to conduct analysis and research. Enhance research and analysis to evaluate and develop programs and practices. This refers back to, are we allocating and utilizing our limited resources in the areas that we need to be focusing on to provide the best results with those limited resources? Clarify identity across to and the outcomes of programs across student populations and geographic regions. This would go to populations, specific demographic areas within the state that are either underserved or require a little greater focus than current. And enable through data analysis policy and resource allocation decisions to address educational inequities and recurring impediments to student learnings. So our timeline. Again, this is a six-month perspective. Obviously, we go out significantly further than that. The strategic vision we currently have takes us out to 2032. So this is just the beginning of the adventure. We have started our partner agency training. That occurred Monday and Tuesday of this week. We had representation from HEC, Chief Ed Office, ODE, YDD, Early Learning, and employment there. So we have real researchers that are conducting real tests and visualization outputs on the system. That is the first session of three that will be conducted this month, and we totally expect to continue training as we expand users within the system. One important element, the repetitive identity resolution and data quality, that is an ongoing process. It is iterative, and that will be something that is part of the system, really, as we go through time. as we get updates with new students, updates from our partners, we have to refresh that information and ensure that the identities are matching across that new period of time that the system has been provided. And again, we are looking at pre-K all the way through workforce. So at each new data load, there's a refresh process that occurs. We are in system testing and validation. Our vendor has been conducting that testing over the last 2 weeks, and we will continue to do testing and evaluation until basically the middle of April or at the end of Q1. This is intended to identify and raise quality concerns, to evaluate and understand that the data that is coming out is accurate and effective, as well as, quite honestly, we want to stress the system to find out what its limitations are, and if possible, if we can break it, understand why we broke it. Our research engagement will start in March and will continue through the June timeframe. We do not expect this to end at that point in time. This is like the iterative data quality process. We expect researchers and policymakers to continue to use the system throughout its life cycle, which we are in hopes will be quite some time. So, system interoperability will be achieved in 5 days. And we'll talk about what that means. So we have automated data exchange. This is direct connect from our master data management engine into the Department of Ed, into the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So we don't have a person that reaches into the system and pulls data. We are notified from both agencies when new data is available. Our system reaches out, provides the appropriate authentication, and it pulls data itself. So this reduces resource impact. It also reduces potential for human error. And quite honestly, it makes our lives a lot easier. Refresh cycles are being coordinated with the agency partners. The HEC, I believe, refreshes every quarter. ODE refreshes throughout the entire year, depending on the specific data collection that's being gathered. So we want to make sure and coordinate them with them, again, not to impact their resources, but to, once they have a vetted data set that they can share, we want to be able to take and coordinate when we reach in and pull that data within our system. Identity management is operational. This is where we are looking at individuals that span basically the period of school year 2006-07 to the present, and we're aligning those individuals across that period of time. This allows us to give that longitudinal perspective from those periods on up through workforce, and that will give us the type of results that enable researchers and policymakers to make informed decisions. Match and merge rules are applied to the golden rule. The device or the machine itself, the system, will provide identity matching across that period of time. The final match is not left up to the system. People have to make decisions. They may need to make informed decisions. So when those conditions exist, we partner with the authoritative sources, our partners, to get resolution on that matching. Case management is applied, and when I say case management, we have suppression rules in place relative to small populations so that identity resolution cannot be reverse engineered. So if it drops below the suppression rules, that information, you'll receive a message that you can't go any further than that in order to protect people's privacy. And then our operational data store and data warehouse are operational. And our suppression rules are applied. We have those in place. Next steps. We need to finalize our governance structure. We have draft governance in place. We need to finish it. We need to get additional input from our partners. What this applies is how we're going to do business moving forward. Transition from a project environment to system operations. We've been in project mode up until this point in time. 2 years ago, when I presented to Ways and Means to ask for money after achieving stage gate 3, we were in total project focus, and now we're transitioning out of project into operations. We need to enter into negotiations with additional partner agencies to expand our data. TSPC is one of our partners. We've had conversation when Dr. Bean was here, and we're still in that process, and we have strong support to share that information. Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, Early Learning Division. We have limited early learning data. Early learning is in the process of developing a new data system, and that system is up and operational. We will partner with those folks to consume their data within our system. And Youth Development Division. This is not an all-inclusive list. Department of Corrections has expressed interest across state organizations, which give visibility to multiple state information. They're very interested in the possibility of sharing information. So this goes to my comment earlier about a strategic vision on out to 2023. The better picture that the longitudinal data system can provide, and I do look at it as a puzzle, we're going to have segments of that puzzle put together here very quickly. We are going to have pieces of the puzzle that we don't have yet, and we want to collect those pieces. Current data. As I spoke earlier, K-12. School year 2006-07 to present. Post-secondary, the same time period, and this is for two-year and four-year public institutions, and workforce system from year 2000 to present. And now I get to be quiet.
For one slide.
For the real quality portion of the presentation.
And when we're all done, we'll ask questions when we're all done with the presentation. Please, welcome.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Lean, and I'm a research analyst at the Chief Education Office, where I'm primarily responsible for the, both the execution and the coordination of cross-agency and partner collaborations for research projects that span the P20W education system. So I, for one, as a researcher, am extremely excited that the SLDS is coming online in the near future, and having just done the 2 days of training, can speak to the fact that we're having conversations around current capacities of the system, but also future possibilities of the system. And so it's a really exciting time to be part of research in the state of Oregon. My first bullet here is, and John has kind of alluded to, is that the SLDS is really a research tool for analyzing data across multiple sectors over time. So it shouldn't be considered a solution in and of itself. It really requires an analytic approach and a research-based or focused skill set to be able to analyze and interpret that data and use that to inform effective and evidence-based decision-making and policy and practice development over time. So I'm on my third bullet already.
That's what you get for having me drive.
I know, right? Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, the conversations are already happening. We've been doing this research for a long time at the state of Oregon and across these sectors, but this is a real opportunity to utilize this tool to expand our capacity in a really awesome way. And so the discussions that are happening are not just around data access and data quality, but rather how, as researchers and as policymakers, do we expand our thinking around our current approaches and the research questions we're asking? So in essence, are we even asking the right questions? How do we know we're asking the right questions? And also, what is the data telling us? What haven't we even thought to ask? So in that respect, to my last bullet, sir, I really think of research in the SLDS as having what I consider a transactional relationship. So the SLDS speaks to us by providing data, access, good quality data, information that we can then take to analyze and interpret. But at the same time, we're feeding back to the SLDS with that information that we've been provided. What kinds of data don't we have? What do we need access to? What should we be collecting? Those kinds of questions. So again, it's really exciting. I'm very excited for this system, and I'm sure you all are too, as you've been waiting for it for a while. So yeah, that's my perspective.
So very quickly, in the interest of time, at the end of Q1, as we showed on our timeline, we are going to launch a public facing portfolio, and this will be open to the general public. The idea is to start the system with transparency. We want the general public to look and see what's going on. This is just the initial offering. As we gain additional information, as we get greater maturity within the system, this portfolio will expand. So one of the questions that you may have, why the focus on CTE STEM? It's of interest. One, two, we feel that we have good quality data around those particular topics. Users will be able to enter into the system, be able to set the parameters within those particular reports, and see various different cohorts of time and results by setting those. So it'll be an experience, not just a snapshot in time, that the general public will be able to take and utilize. And again, we fully expect to be able to take and expand that offering as we gain more knowledge and the data quality becomes more mature. This is an example of some of the visualizations or the reports. This is specific to STEM programs for the school year 2016-17. So this is a snapshot in time and not over time. What this represents are students' participation in STEM curriculum. And this is for that particular school year. The greater concentration of color shows more participation in STEM programs. The lighter color shows less participation. Excuse me. So this visually shows very clearly that there's some opportunities mm-hmm. that exist within certain districts relative to bringing more attention and hopefully participation in STEM programs within specific school districts. Instant, you know, low-hanging fruit, so to speak. This is a longitudinal perspective for CTE programs. the specific cohort, and this was relative to eighth graders in school year 2009-10. Sankey diagram will show, based on CTE status, those individuals within that population that are CTE concentrators, that are not CTE, CTE participants, or CTE attempted. Again, within the system, a researcher or a policy maker can adjust those variables depending on the particular question or research that they want to provide, and it adjusts depending on the parameters that are set. So this is not all-inclusive. If you, just as an example, want to find out within that same cohort, the GED population, what does that look like, you can concentrate down deeper to see that particular population over time and where those folks go. In the interest of feedback.
Okay, any questions?
Questions?
Representative McLean.
There was something that you said the other day, and then your partner also indicated this is not the tool, this is the data. And that,
yes.
And the comment that you made the other day that I thought was important is that you've got to supply the intelligence and the inferences by studying and analyzing the data.
Yes, ma'am.
And sometimes it can become almost a, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. You've got all this data, and then everybody is saying, well, look at this and look at this. Well, you have to see what were the sideboards. You talk about how easily they can manipulate what the framework is or what they're looking at. But to do that, you've got to have some intelligence and some inferences of things you already know and things you don't know. And so it even though it's a dialogue, it has to be an informed dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I love researchers.
Thank you.
And I've been researching since I was 14 as a speech and debate kid.
Yay.
But again, you get taught real quickly about how it can be helpful and it can be utilized right, correctly, or poorly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it's extremely important for us to understand the limitations. And I think I asked where were you preparing your statement about what this is and what it is not, you know, and the disclaimer. Because you get a lot of people using the system, and then they say, well, you know, we have this, and we got this from your system. You say, wait a minute, that was raw data. And so there has to be some discussion about what that means.
Yes, Representative McLean, thank you very much for that comment. This, I don't want to make an inference that this is a totally automated system that removes, informed decision making.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very, very complex tool. We currently contain, and this is just a best guess on my part, about 4 terabytes of information within the system. That is a tremendous amount of information that is utilized. That information has associated definitions that are part of the system, and those definitions need to be clearly understood by researchers, policymakers, in order to make those informed decisions. So because a number comes out does not necessarily mean it's a good number. One has to apply the intelligence to it to make sure the information that's being provided to you makes sense, lies within the definitions that are provided with the data. So this is not a solution to world hunger. It provides informed decision making.
Okay. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the update. As I look at slide 4, the 6-month timeline, specifically, and then you talk about on slide 5, system interoperability will be achieved on 1/15/18. Yay. Mm-hmm. But what does that really mean? Because when I look at it, it looks like it's coordinating with agency partners, which since 2011, there's been tons of time to do that also. And then I see here on system testing and, talking about March being some testing that goes on. Let me boil my question down to, when will there be information that can be accessed and used in a decision-making way to impact education? Because it looks like January 15th is kind of an initial start date, but not a date where there's clear access to data. And I understand putting it in context, of course, and we can pull out, I can get data to say anything I want data to say. And it doesn't mean I'm lying with the data. It means I've stacked it to make a point. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a system that's been online now 7 years. When are we going to use that data to make decisions to impact kids?
Representative Springer, thank you. Excellent question. I'm trying to
boil it down. It was a big question. I get it.
So I think it's important. The development of the system is 2 years in the making. We were funded in 16, about the same time, 2 years ago. So that's just historic baseline. Just so that I'm totally clear, you're wanting to know, when are we going to get ice cream out of the maker? So what we currently have, in open and honest communication, we have a system on the 15th where the visualization engine will be able to talk with the master data management engine. So we can exchange data back and forth. What is yet to be done until we get to the ice cream, so to speak, is to, one, ensure that our data matching is complete and mature. Two, that the data quality is at a level that we are not seeing conflicting results from the output. And that, again, will be iterative in fashion. Our plan is to actually engage researchers really in the February timeframe to start to exercise the system, actually run queries, actually ask questions, start to do what we expect to do and open up fully within a few months. Are we a mature system at this point in time? No, we are not. Will researchers be able to utilize the tool within the next month or two? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Follow up on that?
Yes. So what does that mean, researchers? I'm thrilled to hear that they're going to be able to use this in the next couple of months. Who would those researchers be? Who would they be associated with? And what could they do with that data? Because, again, I love researchers. I go to them for my facts. I also know researchers, like scientists, just love being in the research and love being in the science. And we have millions of dollars in this. And I realize funding was 16, but this is something that started in 2011. I know my history. So when are we going to see pieces of – when are we going to see the ice cream? When are the students going to see the ice cream?
So we expect
or the topping for the ice cream.
Yes. Well, I want them to see the cone. I'd be happy with that.
So the research community, basically the initial research community, are the ones that have been trained and will be trained over this month. We finished our first session. We have another session on the 22nd and 23rd. The final session is on the 24th of this month. That will be the population that will be our guinea pigs, if you want to call it that. And they will be able to start exercising the system based on particular queries that they are looking to have answers to. So that's sort of the vanilla phase of the system. As additional individuals get trained up, that population will expand. As our researchers, the ones that are being trained right now, uncover discrepancies, may uncover quality issues, those are things that we will have to address and work through, and we fully expect that to happen. We've never taken the existing data and literally mashed it together over a longitudinal perspective. Suppression rules are different from agency to agency, so we have to work within those bounds as well. To this point, we didn't know that, so we're going to uncover things that we don't know that we will have to address. But the initial community, they will be able to take and stress the system.
So thank you for the follow-up, Madam Chair. I wasn't clear, and I apologize for that. Are these researchers ODE employees? Who are the researchers that you're referencing?
We have ODE researchers,
okay.
Chief Ed Office
okay.
researchers, HEC researchers, ELD researchers, YDD researchers, and workforce researchers.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Solman.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I had three kind of different areas. I just was curious about confidentiality, and when you talk about shared info and then next steps. And the confidentiality, did you decide if it was going to be related to like a student ID number? How, you know, so that someone couldn't just come and say John Smith, you know?
Right.
Was it?
So I hope I'm going to.
Yeah.
Explain this correctly. So as we consume personally identifiable information, that is the root data that we use to be able to take and match identities. So once we've achieved identity matching, so we have Jeff John Smith from the time they were in first grade all the way until they are in workforce, that information is de-identified. And a golden number is applied to that particular individual. So that's where the de-identification occurs.
But they're so aggregated.
It's not
correct.
Their student ID, it's a number that the system has created.
The system does a random identification, so you can't backtrack.
But that number will follow Jeff all the way?
In our system.
In your system.
That
okay.
is correct.
My next one, when you talked about shared info and full picture, when you said DHS, are you talking about like the work source and folks? I noticed you said had higher education and community college. I was also kind of curious about trade schools and things like that as we're looking at apprenticeships. And
at this point in time, and that's a great question, the data contained within the system really are state institutions.
Okay.
So two-year, four-year public school, we do have a gap in private institutions. Trade schools, we do have a gap in that.
Private universities.
The goal is to partner with those folks, again, to put another piece into the puzzle.
Okay. And last and final is, now what to do with the data once you, that leads so that you can use it as a tool. So on the next steps, when you looked and you showed the map on the STEM, who's involved with STEM education and whatnot, do you then, who takes that? I mean, look at that and go, wow, look at those counties that are good. But who takes that information that then says, okay, well, we need to develop programs here and here? Do you directly work with, like, the STEM hubs? Mm-hmm. You know exactly who then can say, okay, this STEM hub is doing a great job here, this STEM hub.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So so then you would be able to provide, make those direct connections, so that I guess to follow up with Representative Springer, to make sure that the people who are, you know, going to be utilizing that information actually take it and do something about it.
Correct, correct. So the SLDS team would partner with a research group to be able to take and provide the IT support for that research effort. The research folks or policy folks would be the ones that would take that data and develop a corresponding action plan to make that improvement. So we are a service to the research community.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Representative Bonham, then, and Representative Wilson.
Actually, my question's been asked and answered.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hardly know where to begin, but really I don't want this to take a long time. So let me just roll something out to you. And that's the fact that the biggest question that I'm getting anymore from my constituents is, how long is it going to take to improve our graduation rate? As a representative of the people in my district, that's really what my constituents want to know. This is obviously a gigantic process, and it's costing millions of dollars, I would imagine. When I just think of the people who are providing the data alone out of local school districts, this must take a tremendous amount of time, which translates into dollars. So again, I guess the thing I would say, and I'm not sure it's a question, and that is that my constituents want to know when our graduation rate is going to improve, and they're starting to ask for dates at this point in time. So I guess if I have a question here, it would be, how is this going to help me answer my question? How is this longitudinal data collection system going to help me answer my constituents as to what they perceive the real problem is in education in Oregon?
Representative Wilson, great question. I won't lie to you. I think the answer is it depends. I think the tool in and of itself is not going to provide you a date. It's not going to tell you what the optimal class size is for education. It can't do that, and it won't do that. I won't lie to you. Relative to providing information that allows us to focus on specific areas or classes that need greater attention in order to increase graduation rates, it will provide that. Now, providing a specific date, in other words, we're going to see a bump of 2% in the next year, it will not provide that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Okay, Representative Solman.
Thank you. I appreciate the follow-up to Representative Wilson. I was wondering, with the formulating of the new, I'm not going to get the name right, the Joint Committee on Student Success, I was just wondering if this could be an opportunity to where you could partner with that to be able to really show, you know, be a tool for the committee.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, and we'll during the regular session at the end of February, when everything's up and running, we'll talk to you again. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, with that, I close the informational hearing or meeting on the state longitudinal data system, and open up an informational meeting on data relating to youth foster youth in post-secondary. Mr. George? And we also have written testimony on OLIS from the HEC on the data that they have related to tuition waivers for foster youth students in post-secondary. So that is on the OLIS system.
Good morning, Chair Daugherty, Vice Chair Hernandez and Wilson. My name is Kevin George, and members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I am the Foster Care and Youth Transition Program Manager at Department of Human Services. And thank you for the opportunity to come speak today on foster youth and their access and participation in higher education. You know, 15 years ago, I would not be able to sit here and talk to you about the subject because there were not many opportunities for these youth in Oregon. What I'm glad to say is that that has since changed. One message that I continue to preach to our youth and talk to other social workers about youth and foster care is college is an option. College is an option for these youth in Oregon. As you are all well aware, higher education can be a challenge to figure out scholarships and funding opportunities for anyone, and most certainly a youth who may be navigating some of this with limited support. It's also not uncommon for foster youth to be the first-generation student seeking higher education. So let me provide you just a little bit of context as to the child welfare population we're talking about. In Oregon, there's about 7,600 children in foster care. 28% of these are between ages of 13 and 20 years old. So that's over 3,000 kids that we're serving. 40% of these will actually be reunified back with their families. But that means there's a lot of other kids that need something else. The last academic year that we have the data, the accurate data on, for the academic year 2016-2017, we had 203 foster youth in college. 134 of those were represented at the community college level. 48 were at the public universities. 6 students were out-of-state universities. And 15 students were the independent colleges or vocational schools that were just mentioned. Our students are represented in 7 different community colleges around the state, 4 different public universities in Oregon. And then 2017-2018 numbers will be very similar to this that we're talking about now. There are 2 options at this point that are available to current and former foster youth, federal grant program and the Oregon tuition waiver. So the federal grant program is called the Chaffee Education and Training Voucher, and it's a federal program that DHS, we operate out of my office, actually. And it's a federal grant that comes into Oregon and allows us to provide some funding for youth to go to college up to age 23. It allows us to use the money for the cost of attendance, so that's the full meal deal, the cost of attendance, applied after other grants, Pell Grants and stuff are used. And it's available for the community colleges, the universities, vocational schools, and the training programs, which has really been a nice benefit. We are allowed to provide up to $5,000 a year for up to 4 years for youth. And approximately 167 of those 203 youth are accessing this now. The Oregon tuition waiver was a bill that came in 2011, and it has been a wonderful opportunity for many of our youth as well. And it's for identifying young people in foster care. Again, there's criteria and eligibility that I can get into around. You got to be in foster care after the age of 14 for 180 days, and you have to be 16 years old before you exit and all this kind of stuff. But those kids can those young people can access it up until 25. And as most of you know, college now, you don't get out at 22, 23 necessarily. So this is a nice little extra help there. The tuition waiver only applies to the tuition fees, so it's not the full cost of attendance. Approximately 36 of our 203 youth participate in the tuition waiver. It's important to note that the tuition waiver is a last dollar program, which means that all other financial assistance must be applied first. So any scholarships, Pell Grants, Oregon Opportunity Grants are done first. And if there are any tuition or fee dollars still remaining need to be covered, then the tuition fee waiver can kick in at that point for these young people. We have found that many of our students who attend community colleges don't require this waiver, as their financial aid options with scholarships and Pell Grants and Oregon Opportunity cover their tuition fees at that point in time. One condition of the Oregon tuition waiver for foster youth is an annual requirement for them to contribute 30 hours of community service as a condition of the waiver. This was originally added in the law by the foster youth who brought the bill forward. And this has been an area that has both been a barrier to some of the youth who have yet one more condition to meet for one more scholarship. But it's also been a challenge for the universities and community colleges who must track their hours and or validate the hours that the student is submitting within the scope of the statute. What I'd like to say is that we are also working hand in hand with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission around a data agreement. And we, prior presentation, I scribbled a bunch of notes down about other information I want from them now. Mm-hmm. But it is about how do we actually work together and transfer that information so I know what's happening with our youth as they get into college. Because once we close the case and they're now 23, 24, I may not know what happened. Did they ever really graduate? I want to know that information. So we're working on ways to get that information in the future. I want to speak just for a moment about what is working well. The collaboration with HEC, and specifically the Oregon Student Access and Completion, the Office of Student Access and Completion, has been incredible and a great example of state agencies partnering to achieve efficiencies in state government and streamline access for citizens in Oregon. We started partnering together when we first received the Chaffee ETV grant in 2003. So we're a long time into this. And when we received that federal grant, our first call was to say, we don't want to create another infrastructure to do a parallel process and found OSAC at the time, and they quickly jumped on board with us and have been there willing and able to partner with us since day one. And so I have a staff who enters data into their portal. They're able to then see that information, send it to the universities, and so it's a really nice streamlined process. We partner with HEC in a variety of ways now around their Aspire conference. They have a special function or a special attention towards foster youth and making sure we're training all the high school and college advisors about who foster youth are and maybe some of the things that they may need extra assistance on. We provide a dream conference for our youth and have Aspire come to them. And we've had it hosted at Western Oregon University the last several years, where our youth then get to go stay in dorms, experience real-life cafeteria food, what dorms look like, and actually then get some training on how to fill out your FAFSA, how to start preparing for this. As a result, then, many of the high school counselors really are in tune with this information and are talking to our youth when they're in high school about the option of college and some possibilities. The area that we are now focusing on is maintaining and progressing while in school. You know, getting into higher education has been one benchmark and will continue to be a benchmark for us. But I also want to be able to talk about progressing towards graduation. We've had kids that have dropped out for a whole host of reasons. Sometimes it's, I didn't get my financial aid in. I didn't know what to do because I got a bad grade, so I stopped. We can fix some of that kind of stuff by developing other supports for these youth. We have currently Portland Community College, Western Oregon University have both created some models about supporting youth while in care as a retention effort to keep them there while they're in school. So I'm really pleased to share with you that I personally know several foster youth that have been able to gain access to higher education and graduate as a result of the partnerships and the good work happening in Oregon. I can think of three youth who actually helped initiate this first bill years ago, testified on it, that have since graduated. Two of them actually have their master's degrees now. They weren't impacted by the tuition waiver. They were helping to advocate this for other kids that were coming behind them. So it's a good program, lots of good stuff. I think we continue to work towards finding every little piece. There's always a wrinkle, one more thing. What else can we do to really help these youth? But what I can say is the trajectory that some of these young people are having now are stopping the cycle of their family history, and I think that's a great thing.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I think that was 2011 when that law went into effect.
Correct.
Do we have actual data and statistics of how many kids have completed, besides sort of anecdotally some who have, but do we know what the actual numbers are of kids who've gone the full way? Because it's been 7 years, and our average graduation rate is 6 years. Hopefully there's some folks who have actually come out of this. Do you have figures at all for us?
Representative Parrish, good question, and part of that is the data sharing agreement we need with HEC to get that information, because the young people are with us, and we may still continue to be involved with them to a certain period of time. And then once they're no longer involved with DHS for a variety of reasons, they then turn over to the university system, and they may just operate with a scholarship without us even knowing that. So I'm much more of an anecdotal. The kids that we've stayed in contact with that are in leadership roles that are coming back and saying thank you and here's some other things. That's the future of a data sharing agreement, to be able to track those young people all the way through and know what that final outcome is, so that any investment we're doing on the front end, we know, yeah, they've achieved something. So that's exactly the direction we need to go in.
Great. Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that on the agenda associated with your appearance here is LC 236.
Yes.
And I know the Chair doesn't want to debate that bill, and I have no desire to, or that concept.
Oh, yeah.
None of us has a desire to do that today.
We will have our opportunity for that.
Yes, we will. Could I ask you, though, briefly about that LC draft and the impetus behind that? Is that permissible? And I don't want to debate it.
Sure.
I just want to.
Yeah.
And
maybe just an explanation. What it is the law went through and said that the students on this tuition thing would need to put in 30 hours of community service. And I think part of it is the community service has never been talking to the originator of the bill. It was the idea that these kids would go through the system, would help other kids through a mentor program, through a system at the universities, it would be like a mentor program, a mentor center. And that's only been achieved at two universities, and that they haven't really tracked whether the students had been doing this. We're also the only state in the nation that requires this for foster youth. So,
Certainly, Representative Wilson, there was a small group of folks that went to get some training in Austin, Texas here early this fall to really talk about FOSTA youth and opportunities for higher education. And part of what that small group did from here from Oregon with HEC individuals and one of my staff really was talking about what are some of the barriers, what are some of the challenges, are there other things that might get in the way? And granted, when you start looking at the numbers of this, if there's 9 youth at the universities that are accessing the tuition waivers, there's not many that, you know, we don't know how many kids could have accessed that didn't because they didn't have their 30 hours, because it's an administrative burden to the universities at this point in time. And so it is one of those. Is it adding value to the bill, or is it a potential barrier there? And that's really where it's coming for. Mm-hmm. Is this just one more thing for the universities, one more thing for the youth to have to do? And when you start, if you look at the HECS summary on this, they even turned it into dollars and cents that, you know, 30 hours of volunteering at a minimum wage, that's a $300 contribution that they're adding, and is that going to be a barrier or not? So is it just one more stumbling block that really doesn't add value to anybody at this point in time?
And we'll be hearing more about that. Sure. Let me hear the bill. Yeah. Okay, Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question on, you just touched on that. When you talk about the tuition waiver and you talked about it being for community colleges and higher education, I'm sorry, I feel like a broken record, but I was wondering, can they apply and go to a trade school with that and through an apprenticeship program? Does it have to be it has to be?
Representative Solman, I'll get used to it again. We've been out of session for a while. Representative Solman, I'm going to pause for a moment because I'm trying to think quickly off the top of my head. I believe the legislation talks about public universities and public community colleges. I'm not positive the tuition waiver hits the private and or the independent schools or vocational programs. Our ETV program does allow for that.
ETV, okay.
Yeah, and education training voucher.
Follow-up comment is just to say that when you had talked about PCC and Western Oregon University and their mentoring their FOSTA wraparound services to helping students complete, I just wanted to just put out a comment and a further exclamation point to that, because when you look at student success programs like Future Connect, those are all about, you know, if you're looking at graduation rates, those students have a higher percentage to graduate when they have those wraparound services. So kudos to PCC and Western Oregon for working on that.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. I'll make sure I pass that on to them.
Okay, thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could respond to what Representative mm-hmm. Solman was talking about. If my memory serves, in 2011 when we passed that bill, the context of that bill was as far as the tuition waiver, which is a nice way of saying we told the public schools, just don't charge them the rest. We can't go to private institutions and say that. And at the community college level, we were literally talking about, I think, less than $1,000, if I'm correct. So it couldn't translate to the others. It wasn't a check the state was writing. It was simply to the public university or public schools, don't charge them or bill them for the rest of that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So, you know, since that bill passed in 2011, the state has passed the Oregon Promise, which these students would be eligible. How much of this is duplicative now that there is the Oregon Promise in place?
Representative Parrish, because we have this system through OSAC, they are looking for all eligibility for the youth, and then the universities and colleges are looking for any of those things the kids are already eligible for before they get down to the last dollar. Then they would do the tuition waiver. So our kids are accessing those promise grant dollars. It ends up being just the cost of attendance, and then you have, you know, beyond tuition fees, it's housing and transportation, all that. And so that's really where it is. They're accessing everything. I think that, quite frankly, the universities and community colleges are doing an incredible job with really packaging these kids the best as possible. And tuition dollars, the tuition waiver, as you'll see in some of the data that HEC provided, is really pretty minimal at some point in time with the amount of kids that are being served.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. And with that, we will close the informational hearing on data relating to foster youth in post-secondary ed, and open up a work session for the introduction of committee measures. As we know, for our new people, during the short session, we have three committee bills that can be introduced, and a vote for introduction is not a vote on the merits, on the content, or the concept. Nor does it guarantee that the draft will be referred back to the committee, nor that it will even be scheduled or heard. And what this is a procedural formality get bills introduced. So with that, if Alethea could talk, just explain the three bills that we have, and then we will move to, have to do that first?
No, I'll explain
okay.
that first. Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. So there is a document online titled the 2018 Committee LC Summary, so you can look at that. I'll just go through them really quickly. So for the first one, it's LC 111, which extends the sunset allowing retired members of the public employee retirement system to be reemployed as career technical education teachers without a loss of retirement benefits. This takes effect on the 91st day following signee-die, and it extends the current sunset from 2018 to 2023. LC 112, which removes the designee from attending the State Board of Education meetings on behalf of the State Treasurer and Secretary of State, but allows the deputy for the State Treasurer and Secretary of State to attend the State Board of Education meetings on behalf of those positions. And then in statute, it does define the deputy for both of those positions. And that declares emergency and takes effect upon passage. And then LC 236, which was we just talked about, which removes the requirement that foster care youth be required to complete 30 volunteer service hours in the previous academic year to receive the tuition waiver, and that is effective for the 2019-2020 academic year.
Okay. Representative Fernandez.
All right. Chair Doherty, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 111, dated 12/13/17, LC 112, dated 1/8/18, LC 236, dated 12/15/17.
Okay, Representative Fernandez moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 111, dated 12/13/17, LC 112, dated 1/8/18, and LC 236, dated 12/15/17. Is there any discussion?
Process question, not content of the bill. On LC 112 regarding State Board of Education meetings, I realize it's a committee bill. I realize what that means. My question is, who brought that idea?
I did.
Okay. From one of these entities or?
I did.
Okay.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Yes, Madam Chair, just affirming what you said a few moments ago, I plan to vote to move these forward today, but I may or may not have difficulty with these concepts as they become.
And that's absolutely, that goes without question, that we're just moving these along for procedural, and they may not ever be assigned to a committee. You never know. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, with that, is there any objection?
I will.
Okay. If not, then the measures will be introduced as committee bills with one objection. Thank you very much. Okay, anything else for the good of the order? Okay, with that, I adjourn the committee, and we will see you guys on February.